Good morning and welcome to the August 12th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my new co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Welcome to the Mountain Money team, and thanks for being here this morning, Kevin.
Thank you, Roger. Good morning to you.
Today on Mountain Money, we're going to start by talking to authors Naomi Kahn, June Carbone, and hopefully Nancy Levitt, and they're going to talk about their new book, Fair Shake, Women and the Fight to Build a Just Economy.
Then we'll speak with Zachary Bretz, creator of the Park City app, a new app designed to connect Park City locals and visitors with local businesses. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Canis Hart of Park City Rotary Club about the mysterious disappearance of the Running of the Balls Tower and the new tower we will get to see on Miner's Day. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. The Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 banned discrimination in the workplace on the basis of sex. Yet, some 60 years later, women are still falling behind in the workplace. Pay and position disparity continues at workplaces ranging from Walmart to venture capital firms in Silicon Valley. It affects women with high school educations and Ivy League MBAs. So, why do these patterns persist? We're very lucky to be joined this morning by three law professors, Naomi Kahn, June Carbone, and Nancy Levitt. And I, for one, have been really looking forward to the opportunity to ask law professors questions since I still have bad memories of when they used to ask me questions in class. They're going to provide some interesting answers in their new book, Fair Shake, Women and the Fight to Build a Just Economy. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're delighted to be here.
So, what motivated you to write the book, and how did the three of you collaborate on it?
This is Nancy Levitt. I can start.
Please.
June and I used to be on the same faculty. We've all been writing together for years. We've written numerous articles together, and June and Naomi have written two books together, Marriage Markets, Red Families, Blue Families. We teach and write about gender and the family and employment. So we talk among the three of us a lot about gender and sex discrimination and harassment and wage gaps. In fact, we'd originally named the book Shafted. Simon & Schuster said, that's too phallic. And so Fair Shake it is. I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves.
Please. June?
Hi, I'm June Carbone from the University of Minnesota. And we've been working on this a long time. And what intrigued us was that when Naomi and I did marriage markets, we discovered the only group in American society whose marriage rates had increased were first the top 5%, then the top 10% of women by income. And we thought, that's really interesting. Why? And we discovered, because there's so many more men in that category than there are women. And so that got us interested in looking into what had happened to the top ranks of the economy, but also was this a pattern we were seeing everywhere?
And this is Naomi, echoing what June and Nancy have said. And I have to say, I teach at the University of Virginia School of Law. And I have to say, we are all very, very nice to our students. So I'm sure your experiences there were wonderful. But yes, I mean, as June and Nancy have said, we were troubled that the story of women winning was one that we had thought was accurate. And then when we started to crunch the numbers, we saw that women, in fact, I mean, as you started the top of the show, Title VII, from the mid-60s until the late 1980s, when the gender wage gap was decreasing. And then starting in the 90s, it stalled. And so we were intrigued by that. And as Jude said, it stalled at all levels of the educational spectrum.
Thank you. Now, what does the big picture look like in terms of the relative success of women in the modern American workplace?
Nancy.
I can start, and this is really, it gets to the heart of the book. As Naomi said, when we looked at the numbers for college graduates, we found that the gender wage gap was increasing. There was a 2019 Goldman Sachs study. It showed if present trends continued, women wouldn't catch up with men in terms of wages for another 100 years or so. The gender wage gap increases with education. For high school or less, gender wage gaps 20%, college or advanced degree 30%, for doctorate degree more than 30%. We discovered that this phenomenon was linked with the phenomenon of CEO salaries skyrocketing. Since 1978, CEO pay has soared 12,000%. Average worker pay has risen 15%. Here's the heart of the book. The new economy celebrates those who can break the rules and get away with it. And the way they do it is to encourage hyper-competition, rewards for behaviors that produce short-term gains, competitions for dominance that keep everyone insecure. It's kind of the late 19th century robber baron mindset of no holds barred competition. And we came up with the term winner take all economy to describe this critical shift in the new economy as the ability of those at the top to take a much larger share of institutional resources for themselves.
And that phenomenon creeps into all kinds of aspects of modern corporate America in particular. You know, as I read the book, one of the things that really struck me was looking at General Electric as an example of the paradigm shift. And can you talk a little bit about how the General Electric of the 40s and 50s so differed from the end of General Electric as we know it?
Yes, this is June. I'm happy to talk about it. So when we looked, we went back and we read the literature on the organization man of the 50s and the critiques. William White, the organization man, he was loyal. He didn't take risks. He was complacent. He could have been a woman. And we said, what? And he didn't say the woman part. We did. But we then looked. What happened? And, you know, this starts with Milton Friedman in 1962, comes up with the idea that shareholders ought to be run for that corporations should be run for the benefit of their shareholders and only their shareholders. John Kenneth Galbraith is saying during the same time period, shareholders, they have the least interest in the corporation. They're the short-term guys. Fast forward, you get into the 70s, and you get the theorists talking about this need to make corporate America more competitive. And along comes Jack Welch, the manager of the century, CEO of GE from roughly 1980 to 2000. And in that 20-year period, what he's famous for is he beat earnings expectations almost every quarter. GE's earnings went up several hundred percent. GE's share price went up 4,000%. And when you look at that time period, what you're seeing is he gets rid of many of the employees. He brags about cutting through the bureaucracy, reaching down into the ranks, looking for people with confidence to spare, promoting them over others. What we found is, but the system's rigged. What he did, his getting rid of bureaucracy, is something we call plausible deniability. That is, you reward the people. Jack Welch said, no bureaucracy, no supervision, give them a clear lead so long as they meet their numbers. What are the numbers? Quarterly earnings. Produce the right numbers and you're golden. Much bigger bonuses. Bonuses become a high percentage of total pay. And Welch pioneered a system he called rank and yank. You promote those who are really performing. You fire the bottom 10% every year. And you make it clear to people along the way, these are the results I want. And guess what? When you have that kind of system, you get them. It was so successful, Enron copied it lock, stock, and barrel. And Jeff Skilling, the CEO of Enron, who pioneered adopting Jack Welch's system, went to jail for fraud. It also ultimately destroyed GE because it's focused on who can give us immediate results. And because you're pitting employees against each other, You know, somebody complains, oh, my neighbor is unethical. Oh, the way they got those numbers is fake. Well, sour grapes from somebody who didn't get a big bonus and is on their way out the door.
You talk about, and by the way, that employment stacking phenomenon is something that we see adopted through lots of corporate America, and it is inherently going to create a lack of collegiality and an environment of a common good. And we see it everywhere from GE to Ray Dalio. You speak about triple bind that face women in the workplace. Let's go there, because I think that the core of the book is you explaining that triple bind. Let's start with the first step of the triple bind, where you argue that there are invisible rules and that when women don't compete on the same terms as men, they lose. Naomi, what does that mean?
Well, so let's talk about that. We start the book after the introduction. We start the book with a Walmart greeter named Betty Dukes, who sued Walmart for one of the largest sex discrimination class action cases ever. And we use her as an incredible illustration of this triple bind. Before I talk just a little bit about Betty Dukes' story, I wanna go back and I wanna note that when June talks about the organization man, it's not that we're saying that there was no competition. It's just that the competition was not for the highest salary, not for the biggest bonus. The competition was to beat other companies. So it was an externally focused competition. And what the winner-take-all economy is, it focuses that competition internally. And so the first thing you have to do if you want to win is you got to figure out what the rules of the game are. If you can't figure that out, well, you're not going to get anywhere. So Betty Dukes started as a Walmart greeter. She was born in Tallulah, Louisiana, one of 12 children. She dropped out of high school, but ultimately she thought she had found her calling at Walmart. She was promoted a number of times during her first few months there. And she said, you know, I'd really like to keep getting promoted. And she saw the men working next to her getting higher pay and being chosen for management training, but she was overlooked. And when she complained, she was told, people like you don't get promoted. Dukes was Black. Her supervisor proudly described himself as a redneck, so she actually assumed it was race discrimination. and she complained again and ultimately got the courage to sue Walmart. And she became part of, as I said, this very large class action sex discrimination lawsuit. The problem was that the ladders of promotion at Walmart were not what she thought, sort of like, you know, the orderly, do your job very well, you get promoted, you get into management. It was a very different system. And as we note in the book, it's no coincidence that at one point over the past decade, Walmart was number one in wage theft. June, do you want to take over?
Sure. Let me explain.
Yes.
Betty Dukes thought she had found her company. She'd hit rock bottom before she went to work there, thought about ending it all, and then found God. She was ordained a Baptist minister, got her GED, and when she went to work for Walmart, she bought in to what Walmart described as its Christian values. She was promoted to customer service rep, the highest position you could get while still being an hourly employee. And she thought, I have what it takes. I take care of my customers, I look out for fellow employees. And it turned out that's exactly what Walmart didn't want. It hired its managers through a tap on the shoulder, and the qualities it looked for, again, a stakes bonus system, as much as 2/3 of your salary as a manager could come from the bonus. The bonus was total sales divided by labor costs and only labor costs. While Walmart micromanaged things like the temperature of warehouses in its supply chain, it delegated personnel matters and only personnel matters to the store managers. Why? Because it had a system of exploiting its workers, a policy of never paying overtime, chronic short staffing. And it turns out the way it had a uniform national system is it moved people around every few years, often on short notice, often 100 miles away. Betty Dukes prided herself on her roots in the community. She bragged she had deeper roots than Walmart in Pittsburgh, California. She prided herself on her Christian values, which Walmart, when it came to fleecing employees, didn't believe in. She prided herself on her care and concern for others. Those qualities were disqualifying. So the first leg of the triple bind, and many of the women we describe in the book didn't get what the qualities were until they hit what they thought was a glass ceiling or were being pushed out the door. That's Betty Dukes as well.
Right on. Continuing with the triple bind, let's go to the second one, which is women who try to play by the same rules as men still lose.
Yeah,
now the case, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you rightly said, if women compete on the same terms as men, they're punished more harshly for their sharp elbows or their legal and ethical misdeeds. So if women are trying to compete on the same terms, they also lose, because when scandals need scapegoats, women are convenient ones. There's a fascinating article entitled "When Harry Fired Sally," and Harvard economist Mark Egan, whom we interviewed for the book, demonstrated that women who commit misconduct in finance are more likely to be fired and less likely to be rehired than men who commit even greater offenses. Men who are perceived to be narcissists by their subordinates are rated as more effective bosses. Women who are rated to be narcissists are rated to be less effective bosses. They just can't get away with those traits.
You know, the scapegoat concept really comes out in your discussion of the Wells Fargo case. Can you flesh that out a little bit for us?
Sure. So we described a woman, Misha Patel Terrazas, who, you know, worked her way through the ranks, started as a cashier, had become a regional manager, unfortunately, in the epicenter of the fake accounts scandal. And what she was trying to do is to thread the needle. That is, she was giving talks to employees at Wells Fargo describing how, look, you don't have to open fake accounts. Here's how to talk people into opening multiple accounts. Here's where it would be good for them. The Wall Street Journal wrote up one of her talks, included some information she thought was inaccurate. She was fired. The men around her were not. Why? Well, we talked to her and she told us she thought she was a scapegoat. And what Wells Fargo did, again, not so different from what GE was doing, is that it made it hard to know whether or not the accounts were fake. She said she had no way of knowing until after the scandal broke. And then she got some information that if she was diligent about inquiring, she might find out. But in the meantime, there were men who were flat out violating clearly established Wells Fargo rules, and their supervisors knew about it, and they weren't being fired. Why the difference? Well, she was easy to get rid of. Part of what made the other women in that case protected, their managers knew what they were doing and were in on the frauds, so or the misconduct. So if they fired the men were going to turn on the supervisors. She didn't have a powerful protector. But there are other cases. We found other Wells Fargo women where they complained about sex discrimination. Then they were fired for trumped up charges. It was very clear they were fired because the managers didn't like them, but not because of real misconduct. So if you have an environment, a gang of thieves, where everyone is doing something because that's part of the atmosphere, it's often women who are the ones who are fired for a variety of reasons.
And that leads right into the third tier. Let's unpack that a little bit. The third tier of the triple bind is some women get out of the game when they see what the rules are. You say it's not the whole story that women get out of it, get out of the partnership track because they're not as competitive as men and they'd rather stay home with children. why is that not the whole story?
Nancy, you look like you're going to talk.
I talk always. It's kind of the job duty, right? The third leg of the triple bind is it's nuanced, as you're pointing out, that when women see they can't win on the same terms as men, some of them have been pushed out already. Others of them might take themselves out of the game. There are powerful institutional factors that make these high-stakes jobs less attractive for women and push out many women who would otherwise be effective leaders. And when some women see what the terms of the competition are, some of them take themselves out of the running. And yes, childcare responsibilities often do play a role in it, and the absence of any social safety net to support caring for children is also a piece of things.
Yeah.
Can I add a little bit more to that?
Please,
so
please.
What we look at that's different is, first, hours have become artificially high. So when we describe these competitive environments, there's a nice social science literature that describes masculinity contest cultures. And what it says is winning the game against your fellow employees is what you have to do. And when that's the case, putting in long hours for the sake of showing dedication to the job becomes an end in itself. So there are wonderful studies called How Work Got Greedy. Go back to 1960, people who worked longer hours made less per hour than those who didn't. Sure. Today they make more. Take a look at law firm Equity Partners, for example. The average woman makes something like $600,000 a year. The average man, something like $900,000 a year. But they're putting in the same hours to be equity partners. The payoff for women isn't as great. But we think the biggest factor people haven't focused on is the need to stab other people in the back. So there's some natural experiments, put out ads that say, competitive environment, opportunity for advancement, high stakes competitive pay, the number of men and women who will apply falls off, but the gender disparities in those who apply increase by 50%. Women are much less likely to want a part of a job where stabbing your fellow employees in the back is part of what you need to do to get ahead. And if that's clear from the outset, women are less likely to apply. The men who do apply tend to suffer from narcissism, overconfidence bias, amorality, and this system is a selection for those traits.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. Naomi, where do we go from here? What steps do you believe need to be taken to address the inequality and the excesses of the winner-take-all economy?
Well, what Jean just said is a great lead-in, because as she was talking about these highly competitive positions, that we have not written a blame the women book. That is, it's not a question. Women don't just need to lean in and take on those highly competitive jobs and become as narcissistic as the men who are applying for those. Instead, what we advocate, what we discuss in the book, is the need to change the system, the need to create a more level playing field, and the need to create transparent ladders to promotion so that everybody sees what they are and so that everybody does get, yes, a fair shake at applying for those promotions. We have a number of different larger policy prescriptions in the book, ranging from make sure that we have quality childcare for everyone, increase the minimum wage because women are more likely than men to be working at or below the minimum wage, cap the ratio of CEO pay to worker pay. So these very, very large global changes, as well as make sure that where there is harassment or discrimination, there is liability for that. So there are a lot of different places. And then, of course, there individual workers can build their own mentorship environments, their own networks inside and outside of the workplace. They can talk to one another. They can make changes within the workplace for themselves. So a variety of different places we could go, from the global, national, local, and individual level.
We've been speaking with Naomi Kahn, June Carbone, and Nancy Levitt about their fascinating new book, Fair Shake, Women and the Fight to Build a Just Economy. Professors, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.
Yeah, most of us have numerous apps on our phones that supposedly make life easier. Now we have a new one built for those of us who live and or play in Park City. It's called the Park City app, and the person behind it is in studio with us, Zachary Brett. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Kevin. Oh, wow, what an intro. I love that. Thank you so much. I'm buzzing. I'm so excited to be here with you all, Kevin and Roger. Wow, I really appreciate the invite.
Right on. So you're not an app developer by trade. What made you want to teach yourself app design and coding to make this specific app?
Because I'm a glutton for punishment. Hmm. We live in an incredible world where if you want to learn something, oftentimes the resources are no more than a Google search away. And so I learned the hard way, Google University or YouTube University. And really it just came from a motivation to say, you know what, it's so cool to see this new economy, this web-based economy develop around us, and I want to be a part of that. So I just went and started and opened up a computer terminal, and many starts, many stops, but eventually found my way to building some hobby apps, and that built up the skill set to where I was able to build now the Park City app.
How long have you been in town, and what was the need that you see that the Park City app fills?
Yeah, so I'm from New York City originally. I spent most of my life there before a brief pit stop in San Francisco. Early in COVID, we decided that we wanted to move. And so my partner and I came out here March of 2020. And that really was what kind of kickstarted everything. It was literally, a lot of good businesses, right, start from solving your own problem. And our problem was that we'd gotten burned on some early airport rides. And so I thought, you know what, I can build an app and I can drive. So let me put my money where my mouth is and give this a shot. And it took a little while for me to get there and to finally start it. But I did, and started with a very scrappy version of the app. And I put it out there and I said, you know what, let's start with free rides. Let's just give free rides to the community. Because if I couldn't give a ride away, then, well, you know, maybe there wasn't a business there, but sure enough, there was interest, there was demand. People had had the same problem that I did, and enough getting stranded at that 5 a.m. time when you need to get to the airport for your 7 a.m. Flight, and that just wasn't tenable. So people gave us a shot, and it's one of the cool things. I mean, one of the cool things about living here in Park City, people want to see you succeed, and so I'm like, I look tall to you guys. I'm really like 5'2". I'm just lifted up by all of my partners here on the app, including, and I got to give a shout out to, so we have some, we've got some props here in the studio, Daily Rise, some lattes, coffees for you guys. If you're interested, you should be interested. The best coffee in Park City, you can order it on the Park City app. And then Auntie M's banana bread. Watch out, because mm-hmm. you won't stop eating them.
Mm-hmm. So when did the app launch?
So I launched an MVP version, a minimal viable product, just sort of a prototype in March of 2023. And again, that's where I started with those free rides. I actually put it out on Reddit. Most of our users at that time were just ski trippers, people going on Reddit to find out about Park City. And they encountered the app. And at the conclusion of the ski season, when all of that demand just fell off of a cliff, I've decided, this is really the direction that I want to pursue. So I spent a little bit more time building out a more substantial, robust version of the app, and put it out there again, free rides, this time on Nextdoor. Shout out to the Nextdoor community. Nextdoor is awesome. So much support, man. I could go on for an hour just thanking people from Nextdoor. But I put it out there, and so for the last year, last 57 weeks, it's just been off to the races, doing rides. I started just myself as the one driver, one car, one very, very scrappy version of the app, and now we've got a really awesome team of 14 drivers, and boy, do we work hard.
14?
The Next Door app certainly does speak very positively of your punctuality and, you know, sort of reliability in terms of those airport rides. So that initial problem you sought to address seems to be being addressed pretty well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's what it's all about. And that's what I really emphasize to the team. We have a great team of drivers. They're all insured. They are pros. They drive four-wheel drive vehicles, snow tires in the summer. I mean, we're really building in the winter, all seasons probably, in the summer. But, you know, real pro drivers. And I always emphasize to the team, and they're pros. They've been at this game longer than I have as a driver. But I always emphasize to the team, our job is not transportation. Our job is just punctuality. It's to be there on time. And I've got a little anecdote, if you've got 2 minutes to hear it. This is one of my favorite stories, because to me it really represents, you know, small business is hard. It is hard. And I've listened to a number of your episodes, and I don't want anybody to think, not that there's some illusion out there, but nobody should think that we start a business and we just cruise to success, or we cruise to whatever. It is a grind. It is a struggle. And so when I started this business, I launched it July 14th, the most, let's call it the most, maybe not the most recent version of the app, but the app that's most recognizable to what we have now, started July 14th. Well, I had a partner who was very pregnant and due to give birth to our daughter on July 26th. So and I didn't say that I'm the smartest man, right, to start a business at the same time that we're expecting a kid, but I am a hard worker. Things were going well. People were interested in free rides, go figure. And that didn't last for long. Eventually the free turned into paid, demand held. And I said, wow, I'm gonna need some help. I was the one driver, but we have a baby on the way. So really struggling, and now I've got a great system of finding drivers. It's great drivers, no great drivers, but at the time I didn't know anybody. So I found somebody through Nextdoor, and it just didn't work out. So the baby came a little bit late, August 4th, it was a Friday, when we were supposed to get this driver signed up on insurance so that she could drive with commercial insurance. Ghosted, no-showed. And finally get a call at 5 p.m. I'm at the hospital in the delivery room. She says, Zach, can we get on the phone with the insurance agent now? And I said, there's two problems. Number one, their office is closed. And number two, the doctor's between my partner's legs and the baby's on the way. So the next morning, she was supposed to cover a 3 a.m. ride from Jeremy Ranch. The next morning, I, as quietly as I could, snuck out of the delivery room with Katie and our one-year-old now baby Allison asleep, and did that drive. And so that is the pain that I'm talking about. It's saying, you know, we are committed to your rides. If you order a ride, if you give us a shot on the Park City app, we are committed. We will be there. And but, you know, I'm not going to start another business with a pregnant partner again. I can tell you that.
That is outstanding. I mean, everybody here in town loves punctuality, and we don't mind paying a little bit more for something that is definite. You know, definitely the car is going to be there. Now, I love the look of the app. It looks fantastic. It's simple yet creative. How hard was it to, you know, to do your Google U, your YouTube University? How hard was it to create that app?
Really hard. And you would know that even better if you were to order a ride right now. Not because it doesn't work. We will get you there and we're responsive. But, you know, right now, you know, radical honesty, right? Full transparency. A little bit of a bug with the payment. So about 1 out of 10 users right now, when they go to pay through the app, and we use an awesome provider. Stripe is super super secure, processes, you know, all cards, et cetera. 1 out of 10 users right now can't pay through the app. And so when that occurs, I have to draw up a manual form and text it to them. And it's just a little bit clunky at times. Most of the time it does run smoothly, but occasionally I find that there are bugs like that. So it's hard, but the great thing about code is that there are so many resources again out there. So when I have a question, when I don't know like why something isn't responding the way that I want it to, shoot, I'll open up ChatGPT sometimes. I'll copy and paste and drop in some of that code, and it'll say, hey, Zach, this is where the bug is. So it's tough. But hey, man, persistence, you know, I really appreciate that feedback, Kevin, on the playful sort of version of the app that's out now. Some of the earlier versions were not so cute, and it's just hard work and experimentation that's gotten us to this point.
Now, continuing with the credit card payment, so I assume it's secure. You don't retain any of my information, but somehow it's still stored there, so I don't have to enter my credit card every time. If I want to ride to the airport, great, boom, it's all there in my account. Or if I want, you know, five lattes delivered yes. to a meeting, it's all there. I don't have to enter each time.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I'm really glad that you asked that because this, you know, payment security, financial security is a very, very, very high priority for us and for our users. So we use Stripe. They retain all of the credit card information. I didn't want any of the headaches involved with storing credit card numbers, expiration dates, CSVs, all that kind of stuff. So what we do is we retain a user ID that matches with Stripe's data. And so we're able to use that. So we say, hey, you know, John Smith ordered a ride. This is their user ID. And then we send that ID over to Stripe with the amount to charge the card. And that's how that works.
We want to get beyond rides in a minute. But first, you know, as a business show, I'm interested in how you attract 14 drivers. What does 14 drivers allow you to cover in terms of the number of hours per week? In other words, how available are rides from your app? And, you know, how do you find the people that you want to use as drivers?
Man, you guys ask the best questions. This is awesome. You know, again, I'm so grateful to be here, guys. So as I alluded to initially, very much a struggle in the earliest days of the app. How do I find a driver? This is what I did. I'd go open up Uber, and I'd see those little car icons driving around town. And when one of them stopped at a gas station, I'd beeline it over there as fast as I could. I'd knock down their window. Like I said, I'm a big guy, so it's like, how do I be as friendly, as approachable as possible? And it turned out that a lot of these people, I did about a dozen of these, 10 out of the 12 didn't speak any English. And I thought, okay, good for this person. I salute them for pursuing their dream and making it work in America. That's what America is about. But it's not the kind of experience that I want. So I'm going to have to find some other way to find other drivers. Gary Page, shout out to Gary Page, English Taxi, found me on Nextdoor, offers a great service. He's the perfect exemplar of this model where we work with other business providers. Gary's been working for 2 years now independently, and he's just joined us on the app. So when you order a ride on the app, Gary might show up. He gets 90% of the fare, by the way, versus...
That was my next question.
Yeah, right on. You know, a few drivers have found me, Gary, Ryan, these guys, through Nextdoor or through Nextdoor kind of connections. And then... more recently, as I said, it's gotten a little bit easier. I've just gotten connected with more drivers. One guy reaches out, he drives a Suburban, and guess what? He knows like five other people with a Suburban. He wants to see this thing grow. So he refers us to our friends and to his friends, and we bring them on board.
And that 90% number is really interesting. We've done shows about Uber, and that is a vastly different kind of compensation scheme than Uber has, which I suspect really redounds to your drivers and probably wants them to work, gets them to want to work for you.
That's exactly right. So I think the one of the problems that we found is that for those early morning pickups in particular, drivers who often live down in the valley, they might be coming up for a 5 a.m. pickup here in Park City, but they're coming up without a fare. And so let's say a $70 Uber ride leaving from like the Canyons Village area, driver might get $25 or $30 out of that. How much gas did they spend coming up and down Parleys? And how much time did that take out of their day? And so the drivers are great. They're punctual. I think they speak highly of me, not because I'm such a great guy, but because we treat them fairly. We treat them with the dignity, the respect that they deserve. Our drivers are great. They step up in a pinch. They will be there through your flight delays, early arrivals. They find a way to make it work. And again, I think it's in part because, well, they're high character people, but they're incentivized too because they're just incentivized. Yeah.
Well, so that's the driving side of it. Now, the app appears to have no limit to what it can do. Let's say I'm a local small farmer and harvest time, I want to sell a huge crop of tomatoes. Could I do that inside your app? Because I see coming soon,
that's right.
You know, in that corner there.
That's right. Awesome. Yeah, that's great. Yes. So just directly as possible, yes. That's exactly the sort of business that we want to support here in Park City. I think the app is, the vision for the app is to provide a platform for local businesses, local farmers, local service providers, whether you're a babysitter, a driver, as you can already connect with one, Auntie M's a local baker, or a babysitter, I might be repeating myself, but the app is a platform. So I encourage local businesses out there, you know, sole proprietors, small businesses, Park City-based businesses, Wasatch-backed businesses, to reach out and explore with me. You know, my number's on the app, 917-575-1955. Give me a call, send a text anytime. Wake me up at 3 in the morning if I got to. I'll hop in the car. but reach out and let's explore. Let's figure out how can we support your business? How can we connect you? And I'll just mention Nextdoor again here to say that, you know, they're a great platform. We can go on Nextdoor right now and we can find five people that are looking for babysitters, five people who are offering babysitting services, but there's a misconnection there somehow. And so I think this app can provide a lot of that service, but not only can we connect you, we can facilitate the transaction, we can verify you so people know who they're dealing with when they're looking for somebody to watch their kid. And that's a problem that I encountered this weekend when I got somebody who showed and I had to do a drive. And oh boy.
Yeah. Zach, let's talk about where you are currently in terms of other businesses. You mentioned Annie M's. Tell us what businesses you currently have relationships with, and how would that work from a consumer's perspective? For example, can I get my banana bread delivered?
Okay, yeah, great question. We're working on that, actually. Emily mentioned, she said, Zach, I see where this is going, and our business is picking up, and so what sort of delivery deal can we work out? So I told her, just like I told you, Kevin, if you're a local business, let's work together to figure this out.
How about right now?
Order
and pick it up? How does it work?
Totally, Roger, yeah. So right now, if you want the best coffee, let's say west of New York City, then you open up the app, you hit order, you find under cafe, there's Daily Rise, and you order your daily dose of brain juice, as Ben calls it. Again, shout out to Ben Olufsen, a true entrepreneur, a dude who sees my struggle and I see his struggle in what I do as well. And he is just like the biggest breath of fresh air. So you want a coffee, you gotta check out Daily Rise. It's in the market. But Auntie M's, Daily Rise, Jason and Katie Greenberg, owners of Nosh Mediterranean Food, great Mediterranean food over in the Prospector area. And then Clockwork Cafe, again, New Yorker here, I know my pastrami and rye. Clockwork Cafe, you can order that sandwich, and it's for takeout.
So all of these are these are really advanced ordering applications, lack of a better term. So I can use them so that when I pull up to the coffee shop, my latte is ready.
Yes.
Or if I pull up to Clockwork, my sandwich is ready.
That's right.
And so that's your current, and those are the three you have currently, and obviously you're looking for more.
That's right. There are four of them. These guys are and when I say they're my partners, they are really my partners. They're helping me to develop this technology right now. So each of these four locations, when you put in an order, I built a point of sale system that they have on location. And so you put an order through the Park City app. And I'll just say, for anybody who might be trying to order a coffee from Daily Rise right now, I got a little technical glitch. It'll be back online by tomorrow. But you order it, Ben or Jason will receive that order. Your sandwich will be ready. And you'll pay through the app. And so this also goes to your question, Kevin, about payments. We'll remember your card if you want us to. Again, we don't store that information, but we'll remember your ID and we'll be able to charge it again. So that's really, I think, what is essential to the vision of the app. It's one payment infrastructure, one payment platform. So you're not entering a credit card information and dealing with the security issues that might be involved in downloading four different apps for four different things. The vision of the Park City app is to have all of these things that you might need, food ordering, again, finding a dog walker, that kind of thing, and one streamlined payment.
Outstanding. We've been spending the morning with Zachary Brett, the creator of the Park City app. Thank you, Zachary. We'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate being here.
The ball sales have begun, and those who've bought a few dozen are hoping to win a prize. It's Park City Rotary Club's Running of the Balls, held each year during Miners' Day celebrations. Those who've attended remember the big wooden tower up on Main Street that will release thousands of balls. However, word has it that the tower has disappeared. To give us an update on Miners' Day and whether Running of the Balls will happen this year is Corey Forsling and Candace Hart. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
So, the tower, what happened? I mean, does this mean we're not having Running of the Balls?
Oh, no way. Of course we're having Running of the Balls.
Remind our audience what Running of the Balls is, Corey.
The Running of the Balls is an exciting race of 15,000 golf balls down Main Street. Who's going to win? There's many, many prizes. And most importantly, it is the largest fundraiser for the Park City Rotary Club.
Nice. So the tower is where the balls are released, that big wooden structure at Main Street. And I hear it was dismantled and sold for scrap.
Well, there was a bit of an incident.
How did it happen, Candace?
Well, you know, we were storing the tower. A very generous local citizen who allowed us to store the tower on their property subleased part of the property to someone else. It sounds like some miscommunication where the new subleasee just said, hey, can I get rid of some things on the property? And they didn't really clarify what that was. And then the tower itself, which is on a trailer, and of course it's about a 15-foot tall wooden structure, was the object in question, and the person cut it up, destroyed it, and then sold the trailer off. So we only found out when we went out to do our, we annually, right at the beginning of summer, we go out to do some maintenance on it and make sure it's ready for the upcoming running of the balls and Miners Day celebration. And that's how we found out. As you might imagine, it was a little bit of a shock. Choice words were exchanged back and forth amongst us via text as we accepted the reality. But you know, you quickly start to look at it, the glass is half full, and you're like, all right, well, there's literally nothing we can do about this now. The tower has been destroyed. So then you start thinking about, all right, how would you make a new tower, and what would you change about it, and what are the cool opportunities? And that's where we're at, and we're really happy to say we've got a new tower by being built by Reese Co., which is up out of Colville. And we'll be back up and running this Miners Day.
It sounds like it had to happen pretty quickly. Tell us a little about Reese Co. and tell us whether the tower will be new and improved.
Well, thanks. You know, we weren't really thinking we'd be able to pull it off this year. We, as a group, had decided maybe what we should do, because we wanted to really improve our tower, and we wanted to create some, make it safer, make it function better, give it room to grow, but also allow us to bring sponsorship revenue in through the tower. Because remember, Miners Day, all the money that's raised by Park City Rotary Club and Miners Day is donated back to the community in the form of grants to local nonprofits and charities. And so when we think about the tower, we're thinking about how does it function, but also how do you use it to raise more money that we can give back to the community. And to do that, we were honestly thinking, gosh, we probably should look at this for 2025 and maybe just find a temporary solution to get us through this year. And I had visited Reese Co. As my role as a county counselor. I had been on site there once before and reached out to them just to see if this is something they would do. You know, this company, Reese Co., by the way, builds huge equipment. They'll build bridges. They build mining equipment that goes around the United States. And so this is a relatively small project. But when I reached out to them, Bill Wild, who runs the business there, was really quick to point out that we caught them at the perfect moment where they were between jobs and they could build this thing for us. And so then we got to put our thinking caps on and start dreaming of what this new tower would look like, because they designed it, engineered it, it's OSHA approved, and is being built as we're speaking. And we'll pick it up on the 21st of this month, thanks to Reese Co. So they're a great local company that will do huge projects, but also do small things for the community as well.
Nice. So I assume it's going to hold 15,000 balls?
No, actually, that's a great question. So currently, this is pretty amazing. For anybody who's been around a while and knows of the running of the balls, we started back in the day with like tennis balls. And we had blue tarps that used to line the street, and everybody would hold onto a tarp, and we would sort of shake it back and forth to get the tennis balls going. And one year we released tennis balls, but the asphalt was wet. This is how the blue tarps came to be, and the balls just stuck. They didn't actually roll. Eventually we went to golf balls, and I think it was like 5,000 golf balls when we were first doing it, and that seemed like a lot to us. And we used to use upside down rain gutters was the track. It was literally just upside down rain gutters, and we'd line the street. And then eventually we built a track that's 3 feet tall. It has great branding and signage down there. And we get it's funny, we're talking about 15,000, but that's also roughly around the number of people we get out there looking at the running of the balls. So we put some great advertising opportunity in there on this track. And now we're looking at this new tower will hold up to 25,000 golf balls. So it's an amazing amount of golf balls going down Main Street when you think about it.
And do you think you're going to be able to sell 25,000 golf balls, Corey?
someday.
Corey, so obviously, you know, as both of you have mentioned, the funds raised by the Running of the Balls go to various community projects. Can you flesh out a little bit about the kinds of grants that Rotary gives and why the balls running, you know, is an important thing for the community?
Mm-hmm. We have two grant programs that we support. One is an annual community grant program, and we give about $30,000 to $40,000 annually to local nonprofit organizations in town. We tend to focus on the smaller nonprofits that have budgets that are less than $500,000, less than $1 million for sure, because they definitely need our support. Then we also have every few years we have a large grant program where we can give north of $25,000 to a small group of nonprofit organizations. And we had a grant cycle this year where we gave out those large grants, and then we are, our minor stay funding will support our next group of community grants next year. So it's an important part of what we do as a Rotary Club.
Gotcha. So it is on Miner's Day. We're just going to wrap this up. Is it before or after the parade?
It is right before the parade. The balls are released at 10:35 on the dot.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And how do people who are listening get some
pair.
Balls?
How do they grab their balls? They go to parkcityminersday.org.
But they're also being sold live, aren't they? Tell us about the locations where we could actually buy them in person.
Yeah, so you can buy them online anytime, any day, right up until we release the balls. Again, it's parkcityminersday.org. You can also buy them the day before Miner's Day at the bottom of Main Street at the Silly Market. And then you can buy them the morning of the event on Main Street where all the excitement happens.
And what are some of your favorite prizes?
Oh, we have Deer Valley season passes, Epic Local passes, dining certificates. We have $500 to Delta. We have all sorts of great stuff.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So we were spending time with Corey Forsling and Candace Hart discussing running of the balls. We'll be right back in just a moment.